Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Ah, here's our room. True crime.
You've now entered the House of Mystery on KYAH. Utah's Talk Authority with your hosts, Al Warren and Kev Thompson. Also, Julie Saville with the Paranormal Report. The True Crime Commentary by Stephen David Lampley. And Dr. Joseph Usensky's Conspiracy Countdown.
The call had come in early that morning, and we found ourselves on the road again. The details weren't very clear. All we knew was that someone had shot someone with a gun. The man who met us out front of the poorly maintained apartment building was the manager. He wore the solemn look on his face like a mask. We followed him up the blood-stained stairs to the unit at the top. He unlocked the door and stepped aside. If walls could only talk, these would be screaming. The living room wall led immediately into the hallway and was heavily sprayed with blood. In the middle of it all was the only clean space, and it was a clear outline of a body. Crimson spatter and sickly pink brain matter covered the walls and ceiling. What happened? I didn't think a scene like this could get any worse. I learned I was wrong again. This is the cleaning of John Doe.
Oh, welcome back to the House of Mystery. I'm your host today, Al Warren, and sitting on the side is...
Kev Thompson.
Okay. Another day. We're not talking about the weather anymore because we're...
Yeah, because we're kind of all over the place now.
Yeah, so if it's good weather, I'm not going to tease the ones that are having the bad weather. But so here we go, another day. We are going into true crime again, and we're going to be talking about a book out of Canada, and it's called Murder Lost to Time. And it's the true story of one of Canada's oldest unsolved murders.
Ooh, now, a cold case.
A cold case. Now,
this, pardon the pun.
Yeah. Oh. So this just came out, this book, and we happen to have the author with us, and he's going to talk a little bit about how he got to writing the book. Like, what's it about? He's going to get you excited. His name is Joseph A. Lapillo. And he's joining us from Eastern Canada. Thanks for being here, Joe.
Thank you very much for inviting me on the show, guys. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
Yeah. We love talking to true crime writers. So now, if I understand this right, this is really the only book you've written. This is your first.
It is my first book, yes.
Wow.
I haven't.
I was going to say, okay, that's great. So how did you get into writing? Like, where did that come from for you?
That's hard for me to explain because I really didn't set out to write a book. What happened is when I became aware of this family murder mystery involving my great uncle and his cold case that was never solved, I started doing some research, and the more I researched, the more the book more or less presented itself to me, mm-hmm. the story. And it wasn't until after I finished digging up all the documents and doing my research and resolving it, finally solving it, that I decided that I would take a stab at writing a book on it. I believe the story is very unique, and it's all true. The contents of the book, I've taken no literary license to embellish anything or to color anything. This book chronicles my research and my journey back into the past to try and find the people who were responsible for this.
And that was quite a bit of research, wasn't it, if I'm right? I just sort of for the listeners to know, how long did it take you to do all the research and put this book together?
It was very... the research itself took approximately 3.5, maybe a little bit longer, 3.5 years, or a little bit longer, almost close to 4 years, because of the length of time that had went by, and everything was archived, all the documents I needed to get. And then the book took me about 2 years to write. So all in tale, this was a 6-year project for me.
Now, would it be fair to say, though, that an additional motivator is that you have a personal interest in this?
Yes, like I said before, this was my great uncle. This is my father's uncle.
So how did that feel? I mean, you know, were you kind of afraid to look, or did you just dive right in?
I dove right in. I had no fear at all about trying to resolve this. The only apprehension I had, like I said before, was the amount of time that went by. It was close to 94 years, and there was nobody still alive that I could ask about it. But at certain points in my life, the subject of his murder kept coming up. As a matter of fact, just to briefly detail the events of July the 20th, 1917, he was a taxi driver in Toronto, Canada. And he was sitting on the taxi stand with his friend in his car waiting for a fare. And I believe in 1974, 1975, I met this man. His name was Joseph Pill. He was a good friend of my great-uncle. And I didn't know him. He recognized me. He said that I looked my great-uncle. And upon meeting him, I had a brief conversation about the case. Although, at the time, I didn't have any documentation. I really didn't know anything about it. Had I have the information that I have now, I could have asked him some questions that would have made my research a little bit easier, but I just didn't have it at my fingertips at the time.
Well, how fortunate, though, that like you said, you were able to actually get documentation. I mean, you know, let's be intellectually honest. It's been over 100 years. Stuff gets lost, stuff gets shuffled, gets destroyed. You know, hey, we don't need these old records anymore. Send them to the shredder or to the incinerator. But you were able to put your hands on everything.
Well, that's exactly right. And I was fortunate to a degree, too, because the only existing police report on the homicide was archived at the Province of Ontario Archives. And I was told, too, that after 100 years, they discard 100-year-old documents. They don't keep it anymore because they figure who's ever interested in it. So had I have not gotten this one remaining report, which was very helpful in me solving the case, like if I had tried to do it now, it probably wouldn't be in existence anymore.
Man,
and the case
would have
been unsolved forever.
Yes. Well, you ran the clock out, didn't you?
I sure did. You know, and I guess I was fortunate that I had came to a point in my life that I was allotted some time to be able to work on this because it was quite tedious. One of the problems was where to start. With the amount of time that had gone by, like even the place where the murder had taken place, the street names were changed. I couldn't find it on a modern day map of Toronto. So I had to go to, I had several visits at historical societies to try and find out where the location was really at. I also had to find out about the Ontario Temperance Act, which was akin to prohibition, alcohol mm-hmm. prohibition in the United States. And I wasn't even aware that this was instituted in 1916 in Canada, alcohol prohibition.
Right, right.
So when I first started researching the case, the only thing I had was some newspaper clippings that I got from the archives. And the rest of it was all a maze that I had to sift through. It was a learning curve, too. A lot of legwork. And the more information I gathered, like I said, the book more or less wrote itself.
So maybe let's bring up the actual crime itself. So you were saying he was a taxi driver, and he was, I guess, doing a he was doing his job. And so what happened to him?
What do you mean it happened to him? You want me to tell?
Like, how did it
describe it?
Yeah, describe the crime itself.
Okay. On the night of July the 19th, 1917, he was sitting on the taxi cab stand with his friend, Joseph Pill, and he was waiting for a fare. Now, the way it works on the taxi stand, first car up gets the first fare. At approximately 11:45 p.m., quarter to midnight, a man and a woman approached the taxi cab. The woman went to his side of the car, the driver's side. He was sitting on the driver's side. The man went to the back of the car. Both of them were very sloppily dressed. But the thing about them was they both made a very concentrated effort in concealing their identities. The woman wore a very large, wide-brimmed hat that drooped down and covered the features of her face. The only thing Joseph Pill was able to tell the police about her was approximately her age and that she had two very large prominent front teeth. Mm-hmm. Her face was obscured by a hat. The man walked around to the back of the taxi cab. He had the collar of his coat pulled up and the cap he was wearing pulled down. So he couldn't really be identified. He didn't speak a word throughout the whole meeting. The woman made an attempt to hire him to take her out to an area called High Park, which is west of Toronto. And she said that she had been out that way a couple of nights before in the green car with the white stripe. Well, that was a description of the car that he was driving. There was also one other man that had the identical colored car but wasn't working that night. His name was Frank Lombardi. And after some talk, like, at first he refused to take them. They were very scruffy looking, and he, it was said by a couple other drivers, they looked like they didn't have the money to pay the fare. But it was also said during an inquest that Carmine, that was the victim, my great uncle, wasn't shy about asking for his money in advance, the taxi fare in advance, if he felt the people couldn't afford it.
Hey, no problem with that.
Yeah, no, he had no problem doing that, but he never did ask for that. And that's the thing that raised a red flag with me during the investigation, is that if he originally didn't want to take them, what was the reason? If it was that they didn't look like they could afford it, well, why didn't he ask for them the fare in advance? That would have settled the matter right there. So what was his real reason for not taking them? And that's what I had to unravel during the investigation. Because a lot of things were... although it was reported in the newspaper and testimony from people, it didn't really tell the real motive behind everything that was going on at that taxi stand when she tried to hire him. In any case, 15 or 20 minutes went by. It was shortly after midnight, and he finally agreed to take them to the destination they were asking to be taken to. Joseph Pill exited the car on the passenger side. She got in, and so did the man, but they both got in the back seat of the car. They left the taxi stand, and that's the last time his friend ever saw him alive. That was shortly after midnight. At approximately 5:15 a.m. in the morning at Humber Bay area, which is west of Toronto, his body was found. He had been stabbed approximately 14 times all in the back. And his taxi was standing in the middle of the road, and his body was in a very shallow ditch, approximately 25 feet away from the car. And a great deal of suspicion fell on this man and woman, who were never identified. They were never identified in a police report. No witness came forward. There were two rewards offered. Nobody ever mentioned them by name. And shortly after I started gathering just this information through newspaper articles, I realized that in order to solve this crime, you have to be able to... the task would have been to try and identify these people after 94 years. Because I knew they were involved with her. I mean, the only reason for them to conceal their identity was they knew what was going to happen to them later on. They weren't the ones that actually committed the murder. Their job was to lure him out there. However, the woman was the mastermind behind this whole plan. Even the manner in which his body was left was all staged, but they didn't know it. The police didn't know it at the time. And as a result of the staging of the body, they seized upon the motive, or what they thought was the motive. They thought it was from a street affair, or he had offended somebody's wife or somebody's woman, and this was revenge for that insult. However, that wasn't the true motive, because he had been he was married to a woman in 1914 when he was 17 years old, and the marriage was recently annulled in Buffalo, New York. Now, you couldn't get a divorce in Canada without going through an act of parliament. So what people did was they went to the United States and got it annulled there. Well, the annulment was already granted, and he was like a buck in heat. All he cared about was getting his ex-wife back. He was madly in love with her. He had eyes for no other woman. This is what cast doubt on the theory that the police came up with about him being killed over an insult to another woman. He wasn't interested in any other woman except his ex-wife. So I knew that motive was false. So I had to find the real reason for the motive. And
now,
there was nobody I could ask about it.
Now, before we get to the motive, though, I mean, let's back up just a little bit. How are you so certain that he wouldn't have an affair? Or, I mean, what proof do you have that maybe this wasn't just a, you know, I'm caught up in the moment thing?
Yeah, like an affair that went wrong, or maybe he said the wrong thing to this woman and man and insulted her, and the man acted in revenge. I believe it was 3 or 4 days before the murder took place. His estranged wife was going out with another man. He had confronted this man in a garage in downtown Toronto. They got into a heated argument, and my great uncle actually struck him and knocked him to the ground and told him, "You keep away from my wife." As far as he was concerned, she was still his wife.
Okay. I can understand that.
Okay. So this is one of the things. Now, had he been involved with another woman, or had eyes for another woman, or was interested in any other woman, would he be acting like this to the to the man that was now seeing his ex-wife. I mean, it doesn't seem very logical, does it?
No, not at this point, no.
You know, it's like... Yeah, but this was not a spur-of-the-moment thing either, and one of the things that cast a lot of doubt on that was the manner in which he was lured out there, see? And later on, I was to find out the real motive behind this. Like I said, the Ontario Temperance Act had been passed. And I searched through the archives of Toronto through the police court record books one day. I read through approximately 3,000 pages, and I found out that he had been arrested on the charge of ISA, which was the illegal shipping of alcohol. The Temperance Act was passed in 1916, which made alcohol illegal. But in 1917, there was another law passed making the shipping of it illegal.
Mm. So he was a rum runner.
Well, exactly. What had happened was a lot of times alcohol was shipped to different locations. In the United States, they used to call illegal drinking places speakeasies.
Yes.
In Canada, they used to call them blind pigs.
Called them what?
And, blind pigs.
Oh, that is cool.
Yeah, that's what they said. That was the... And there was quite a lot of them operating in Toronto because no one's desire to quit drinking coincided with the law that was passed. You know what happened in the United States. More people were drinking once they passed the prohibition. Yeah, well, that's the same thing that happened here. And he thought this was he could make some extra money by being more or less a delivery person for the bootleggers. I mean, they had stash houses at these blind pigs, these speakeasies. They would keep a supply of alcohol that they needed for two or three days. That way, if they ever got raided, they would only get a two or three day supply of alcohol. That's all the police would get. They wouldn't keep their whole stash there. I mean, they didn't buy alcohol, you know, 30 cases at a time. They were buying 200-300 cases at a time, storing it somewhere and getting it as they needed it, because the people that ran these speakeasies, you know, they would have maybe 50 speakeasies in an area, and they had to supply all of them. Well, you know, they couldn't buy 30, 40 bottles at a time. So he would, you know, him and other taxi drivers, people with trucks, cartage trucks, moving trucks, they would ship, and move this alcohol around for the bootleggers. And another thing that made me very suspicious was, in 1915, he's borrowing money off of his wife, and in 1916, he owns two taxi cabs, or supposedly he's the owner of the two taxi cabs. But they're registered in someone else's name. This made me very suspicious, too. I mean, the only asset of the taxi business are cars. Well, why don't you have them in somebody else's name? The only reason to have them in someone else's name is if they were being used for an illegal purpose. Because if, like, say, you were caught shipping alcohol or delivering alcohol, they would not only seize the alcohol, but they would seize the vehicle you were using to transport it.
Yes,
but
just like today, if you're transporting drugs, they'll take everything.
That's right. But what the bootleggers or the people would figure out is, if the cars were registered in somebody else's name, then the real owner could come to court and say, "Well, man, this man was only driving the taxi cab for me. I didn't know what he was using it for." And I did some research into that, too. It happened more times than you care to mention. That's exactly what would happen. The bootleggers, the real owners of the cars or trucks or whatever the alcohol was being used to transport in, they would show up at court and say, "I had no knowledge of this." And because they The court couldn't prove that he had knowledge or he was involved with the alcohol business. They'd have to release the cars or trucks back to them.
Not so easy today.
No, now you can't get away with that.
Now we suspect that he's possibly, running alcohol. But you said that the body was staged. So
the crime scene was staged.
What did that mean?
Okay. His body was found. Like I said, he had been stabbed 14 times all in the back. But in the police report, it describes that his pants were pulled down and his privates were hanging out. Okay. Now, I don't know if anybody, if your listeners or anybody else is familiar with Italian customs and traditions, but whenever there is revenge for an insult to another man's woman or wife, done by the husband or a jealous boyfriend or something, this is a very typical manner to leave the body as sort of a statement to everybody else. Don't offend my woman, don't offend my wife, because I'll leave you you're left in a state of disgrace for all of eternity when you're left in that manner.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why I knew, this is one of the things that led me to conclude that the motive for the murder wasn't a spur of the moment thing. It wasn't really an insult to somebody's woman or wife, which is exactly the motive the police seized on, because they had no other motive. But his behavior before that showed that he wasn't interested in any other woman except his ex-wife. So the planning of leaving the body in that state was to mislead the police.
Misdirection.
As the motive. Yes, exactly. I mean, one of the most important elements in any crime is motive, and in murder especially. You find out, why was this done to this person? Well, why was... And so they didn't have anything else to seize on it. So they seized on that he insulted somebody's woman. The man got enraged and took revenge out on him, and he was an Italian, and there was a bit of an Italian population in Toronto at the time. There was a wave of Italian immigrants in the early 1900s, but that was one of the traditions.
Now, in their defense, in the authorities' defense, though, they did not have the investigatory methods available to them that they have today. They kind of had to just take everything at face value.
Oh, exactly. Oh, I don't fault them. I mean, and even in one part of my book, I mentioned that the investigative techniques 100 years ago are almost primitive compared to what they have today.
Yes, and I said that to say this, though, because if you're trying to piece together the scene in your head, you've got this man's body in the middle of a park, and his pants are down, and his genitals are exposed, and we know that that is an allusion to something cultural. Would that say to the investigator that this man was caught in the act right here, or was he killed someplace else and then brought here as a public example?
The police seized on the motive that that the insult was to this woman who was with this man the night that they hired the taxi cab. That's what the police, they thought it was a street affair, or that he had said something to this woman in the presence of her husband while he was driving them out to that area, and it enraged the woman. And another reason that I knew this was phony, this was all staged, was at one point the police were getting very close to an address in Toronto where they could have done some very serious investigating into the murder. And the woman was hiding in Montreal, Canada, which is east of Toronto, about 350 miles. And the woman took a train on the way back to Toronto. And on the train, she met a young Canadian soldier, a man by the name of Arthur Colin Kilmer. She got into a conversation with Arthur and asked him to pick up her suitcase in Toronto and offered him $5 to do it. Well, $5 was a weekly wage back then. And he was a little bit taken aback by that. He says, well, you know, why don't you pick up the suitcase yourself? And she explained to him that a week earlier, her and her husband hired a taxi cab to go out to the High Park area, and that the driver had said something to her that enraged her husband. And she didn't know what happened after that, because she departed their company and went up the road. All she knows is the next day the taxi driver was found murdered.
Oh.
Now this, you've got to keep in mind, this is 7 days after the murder. This is 7 days after the murder that everyone in Toronto is talking about. It's in the newspaper every day. There's three police forces working on it. They can't come up with a clue. And all of a sudden, she admits to a perfect stranger her and her husband's involvement in it. Well, the result of this meeting, oh, by the way, she also had a drink on the train with this young private in the Canadian Army. Shortly after the drink that they share together, he takes ill. And halfway to Toronto, there's a small city called Belleville where the train stops. He had to be taken off the train and admitted to the hospital. The doctors diagnosed that he had been poisoned.
What? And
wow. He had been poisoned. The woman obviously poisoned him.
Why would she if she needs him to get the suitcase?
Okay. Well, the getting the suitcase was a ruse. That she wasn't interested in getting her suitcase at all. She laid this story on him, knowing that after she poisoned him, the police would be called in. Because, I mean, his suspicion, Arthur Colin Kilmer, the Canadian private, his suspicion was aroused by her offering the money to pick up the suitcase. And then when he heard the story about her and her husband being with the man that had been murdered, that this unsolved homicide that everybody in Toronto was talking about, three police forces were working on. I mean, why is she telling him this? He's a perfect stranger. It's 7 or 9 days after the murder, and she's admitting of their involvement in it. The only reason she did this was she knew that after poisoning him, he would get in touch with the police, which is exactly what he did. He told his story to the investigating Ontario Provincial Police officer, and what he did was he went to Montreal to look for her, because during the conversation, she had said to him that she was returning to Montreal. That's where she lived. She actually showed him a return ticket. The fact of the matter is, where she told him she lived in Montreal didn't exist. There was no such place. But she did show him a return ticket, which she could have bought. You know, she didn't have to show any ID. She just could have bought a return ticket, showed it to him. Because at the same time she did this, the police were getting close to where they could find out some clues in Toronto. So I believe there was a phone call made from the house that they had visited. Actually, two police forces had been down at this house in Toronto asking questions. The people panicked. They phoned her. She devised this plan, got on the train, spoke to the young Canadian private, poisoned him, knowing that he would call the police, and she used him to relay her false story to the police. And the result was the police went to Montreal to look for her. She was never going to be in Montreal. And that's so, not the only... Okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, because we're getting ready, you know, we're running short on time. So what conclusion, after your investigation, what conclusion did you come up with?
My conclusion was that my great uncle had got himself involved in the illegal alcohol trade. The book also describes how that happens. There was a lodger at his parents' house that had ties to organized crime and got him involved in it. I had to dig that up too. Mm-hmm. And I think during one of his arrests, because he was arrested twice, the police flipped him, made him into an informer. And he had informed on these bootleggers, which were an Italian organized crime group. And they made plans to get rid of him. He was killed in July. In February, he received a letter threatening his life, telling him to stop talking to the police. Now, this was in a newspaper report, but it didn't say what he was talking to the police about. That's what I had to find out about.
So he was made a target by the media. That, I think that's fair to say.
This is after the murder. It came out that the letter was received in February. Actually, he was already murdered when the newspapers reported that he had received this letter threatening his life in February.
So this was found during the police's investigation.
Exactly. He didn't receive the letter and go to the police. He received this letter. It told him stop talking to the police. But what I didn't know was what he was talking to them about. That's what I had to find out. And once I found out his involvement in the illegal alcohol business, then I had to identify this man and woman from the taxi stand. And like I said, they didn't actually commit the murder. They planned it. Their job was to lure him out there. But someone else committed the murder.
Yes. Well, I mean...
This is a multi-layered mystery.
It is
not on one plane.
It's like an onion. You peel off that top layer, and there's another one waiting beneath.
I unraveled one mystery, and finding out who these men, who the man and woman were that originally hired them, like I said, this was the key to solving this crime. This took a long time for me to do. Their names were never mentioned. They were never identified. No one ever spoke. I had been in touch with descendants of the people that knew my great uncle and everything, and were involved in the case at the time. It was never passed on from one generation to another. Their names remained a secret. But I had to find out who they were. There was no sense going any further. They were the key to the whole crime. That was the first mystery. Then you have to find out who actually committed the murder.
Well, sounds like you've got a series to write.
Well, it's all in the book, and what's that?
No, and I was going to say, the book "Murder: Lost of Time" is the true story of one of Canada's oldest unsolved murders. Where can our listeners find your book?
They can get it on Amazon. All we have to do is go to Amazon.com and type in "Murder Lost of Time." It's available in paperback or in a Kindle book. Very reasonably priced. It's under $20. It's got photographs in it, and it details not only my investigation, but it unravels the mystery from 100 years ago as to what happened to my great uncle, why this was done, who did it, and what happened to them.
Now, how can people get in touch with you? Do you have a website? Do you have contact information if they think they may have something that's relevant to your research?
I'm afraid right now I only have my own personal email.
Uh-oh.
I don't have a website.
Okay. Al, you still there?
Yeah. Yeah. Just waiting. Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks very much, Joe, for being on the show.
Yeah. And thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it very much. And I hope your listeners will pick up a copy of my book. I know they'll enjoy it. It's a great multi-layered mystery, and it'll keep them guessing and thinking all the way through.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you for taking your time out for us today.
That's no problem.
Okay, we're back. And now with us is Joe Yasinski, and he's got the top five Christmas conspiracies. So here we go. Mm. Welcome, Joe.
Welcome. Hey, great to be back with you, and Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays to you and everyone out there listening. It's a joyous time of year. It's a great time of year for conspiracy theories, too. And I've got five good ones, and they will pique your interest, but I hope they don't ruin the holidays for you.
Well, you never know.
So, number five, and I hope I don't ruin one of everybody's favorite holiday movies, Elf. But there is a Elf conspiracy theory, and that is that Elf isn't a happy little elf. Instead, he is a perverted sexual predator.
Ooh, good.
And this makes perfect sense given the news lately. But what they say is that there's a scene early on in Elf where he's taking a shower naked up in the North Pole, and you see him in a tiny little shower. So he knows what showers are, and he knows how to take them. But then later on in the break room, he's with the main female lead, Zoe DeSantel, and she's taking a shower, and he's there watching her and starts singing along. And she says, "What are you doing?" And he goes, "Oh, I didn't know you were naked. I didn't know what showers were." So the conspiracy theory is that he's just sort of a perv, because obviously he does know what showers are. And then he goes on, you know, if you view the rest of the movie in that light, you can pick out some other instances where he could potentially be sort of a weird predator. So that's our number five Christmas conspiracy theory.
His last name must have been Weinstein.
It's a Hollywood movie, yes. So.
Yes, Will Ferrell groped me.
Yeah. Oh, there you go.
Number four, of course, has to be Starbucks, and that is this year's coffee cups are part of the gay agenda, mm-hmm. And it's because they have a stencil of two hands at the bottom of the cup, if you look at the cup, and they say it's two lesbian hands holding each other, and that's supposed to be symbolic of the gay agenda. It's supposed to brainwash people into becoming gay.
Well, yeah. I got the memo.
Well, I didn't. I'm confused.
Well, they sent me the memo. You know, that's the job.
So, every year, I mean, we're all aware that Starbucks takes a lot of heat because people say that they're part of the war on Christmas and that they are putting out coffee cups that don't celebrate Christmas but instead celebrate something else. And this year, they've taken that idea to a new level where they say not only is it anti-Christmas, but it's part of the gay agenda. If you look at the cup, you see a stencil of hands near the bottom. But there's stencil throughout the entire cup. If you get the I usually get the venti mocha latte. So at the bottom, there's hands there, and people think the hands are lesbian hands. It's hard to tell because it's a stencil. But some people are absolutely convinced and have boycotted Starbucks until they remove the lesbian hands from the cups.
I can tell they're lesbian hands.
well, there is an article about this where they talk to some people and they say, "Do you think that the hands are lesbian hands?" They say, "You can't tell, but they're definitely gay hands."
Oh, so you know, I'm looking at it right now, and I'm sorry, I don't see it.
Well, the point is some people do, so.
I get it. Touché. Touché. You're the expert.
Yeah. Well, there you have it. Now we know. I'm just going to go out and order one right now.
Number three is that Obama banned the word or the term Merry Christmas, and that Trump is the one bringing it back, and he's taking a stand for Christ by doing so.
Now, that's true. That's not a conspiracy.
Oh.
So I don't remember not being able to say Merry Christmas last year during the Obama administration. Maybe that was the case. And I don't know if we're saying it more now than we did during the Obama administration. And of all the people to take a stand for Christ, I'm not convinced it's Trump.
Right.
But nonetheless, this is a popular conspiracy meme that's been going around on Twitter. So if you like Christmas and you felt that you were oppressed during the Obama years, you are probably happy now, and you're probably saying Merry Christmas to everyone. So,
and boycotting Starbucks.
Yes, all thanks to Donald Trump.
Well, he's making it better.
Making Christmas great again.
Yeah. Oh, my.
Number two is a favorite of mine, the Da Vinci Code. Christmas is about Jesus and his divinity, and the very popular Da Vinci Code conspiracy theories suggest that Jesus did, in fact, exist, but was just a mortal man and fathered children with the prostitute Mary Magdalene. These children escaped to France and became the royal family of France 2,000 years ago. So that's our number two. That's a fairly popular one.
Wow, I've never heard that before.
Yeah, well, let's explore that for just a moment, Joe.
You didn't see the movie with Tom Hanks?
Well, I did, but is that referring to the Merovingian line?
Yes, exactly, yeah. So the reason why I like this, and I'll just put a plug in for my home state of New Hampshire, is because Dan Brown, who wrote the Da Vinci Code, is from two towns over from where I'm from. So that could be a conspiracy in itself. But that's a very popular conspiracy theory. And there's actually a lot of research and pseudo-research into tracing this bloodline back to Jesus Christ.
Wow.
Well, let me amend that one. Is it? Well, hell, you got me, Joe. You got me. Is it not true, though, that nowhere in the Bible, and this is another conspiracy, nowhere in the Bible does it say that Mary Magdalene was a prostitute. That was actually added later on by the church itself in order to kind of, you know, shy people away from the possibility that Jesus and Mary were actually married.
That may very well be the case, because it was a few hundred years later when there was a council that sat down to decide on which of the books would remain canon. And it's sort of like Star Trek.
Yes, you know, the Council of Nicaea.
Yeah, which ones remain in the canon and which ones are no longer canon. And that's going on with Star Wars, too, but they had to do it with the Bible 1700 years ago.
Look, I can tell right now. When I Mary's hand is on the cup because she's a lesbian. and that started the whole problem, because we know Jesus was gay, and so that's why they have the gay agenda with the Starbucks cup.
So Starbucks is, by doing that, is actually the most true Christian.
Exactly.
Of anyone.
It's where you have to be. So therefore, start buying two a day.
And God did recreate the world with a rainbow. If you read the story of Noah.
And well, Starbucks.
Don't tell Roy Moore.
No. Uh-uh. Stay away from there.
Okay.
Alabama.
Okay.
America.
And our number one is that Jesus did not exist, and this comes from the very popular Zeitgeist conspiracy movie, and the idea is that Jesus never existed. He's just based on the same thing that all other major world religions are based on, contemporary and those religions previous to Christianity, that they're based on the stars in the sky and the rotation of the earth around the sun, and they have to do with, you know, day and night and growing crops and whatnot. And if you follow that movie later on, they tie all of this into the financial markets and 9/11. But that's our number one, sort of a downer, but that Jesus did not exist.
Wow.
Merry Christmas.
Yeah.
That's a little stocking stuffer from Joe there.
Yeah, merry ho-ho. There we go. Well, it gives you more of a reason to go out and shop.
Well, that's the whole, that's what they say the whole point is to prop up the the oppressive capitalist financial system and to oppress us without us even knowing it.
Well, that's perfect.
Happy holidays.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, Jesus was a reptilian. Coming up next week.
Well, I thought it was Hillary.
Well, okay. That's a whole other show.
Yeah, that's right. She smells like sulfur.
Is that so? Reptilians smell like sulfur because they're reptilians or because they travel interdimensionally?
Well, because they live underground.
Oh.
The earth is hollow but flat.
Oh. Yeah, you know, I'll leave it at that. That's how it is. Well, Joe, thanks again, and we look forward to you in the new year. And you'll be on the first show counting down the 2017 conspiracies.
I will, and Merry Christmas to you. Happy holidays to our listening audience, and I look forward to being with you again in the new year.
Joe, thank you so much for being on with us.
All right.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.